going back to Cairo Nights, I talked about this story earlier in the show, and I'm really excited to get the writer of the story. One of my favorite sports writers, I think one of the best people working in sports writing in the country, Dave McKenna. Dave wrote a piece. If you have followed Seattle sports for any time at all, you know that maybe the greatest basketball player, one of the greatest athletes ever to come out of Seattle, is Elgin Baylor, who starred at Seattle University and had an epic run in the NC2A tournament when he was there. This Dave McKenna piece is about Elgin Baylor and also his decision, because he didn't start at Seattle U. What a lot of people don't know is he actually started at a little college in Idaho. And for a kid who grew up where he grew up, it was a big leap of faith to go there. Dave McKenna, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Oh, well, I can't live up to that introduction, but thanks for being so nice.
Well, you've already lived up to that introduction, so we're good. Hey, so Dave, what has drawn you to, when we talked earlier to get you on the show, you were gushing enthusiastically about Elgin Baylor. What is it about Elgin Baylor that draws you in? Because I'm a huge fan, but a lot of people in Seattle, I think the younger people, don't remember what kind of ridiculous basketball player and man this person was.
Yeah, it's way more than just basketball. He's worthy of incredible inspection or review just for his basketball, obviously. But his timing, I'm from Washington, D.C. I grew up 6 miles outside the city. I've been in the city for 34 years inside the city, and I love sports and I love Washington. And there's not, the intersection of sports and history, and especially the cultural and racial history of this place, there's nothing like Elgin Baylor. I mean, he graduated high school in 1954. The 2 months earlier, like right before he graduated, the Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court ruling that eliminated segregation, legal segregation, and made it, ruled it unconstitutional, was handed down. And that changed D.C. more than it changed any other city. D.C. was the first major city to implement that. D.C. at the time was statutorily segregated. Every school was either all black or all white. There was absolutely no mingling, to the point where, like, you know, black artist Marian Anderson, a famous opera singer, was not allowed to sing at a public white high school. It was just incredible. And this is the nation's capital, and people don't realize this about this place. But it went in 1954 with the ruling that at least there was some attempt. They immediately implemented it. But it was too late for Baylor. His school experience, his Washington experience, was one of complete segregation, where he was not allowed to use the nice park across the street from his house, very close to Capitol, like the U.S. Capitol, it was on Capitol Hill, because of his race and stuff like that. To get any exposure, and he was not given a lot of exposure in the mainstream or white press, the Washington Post, etc. And so, like, one part that I go over in this story, that's just a fascinating chapter in his life. Like, to get him some press, the black media, the Afro American, which was a national paper geared for a black audience, produced these games where they'd match Baylor against the best white players that the area had to offer, including a guy from the white high school named Jimmy Wexler, who had the previous scoring records that Baylor smashed, and Gene Shue, a future Hall of Famer, with the coach of the Washington Bullets and the 76ers and a great player himself. He was at the University of Maryland, the all-time leading scorer at University of Maryland at the time. He came and played Baylor in front of large black crowds, these black versus white race matches. And he dominated. Wow. He showed, he was playing a game. Like, Jimmy Wexler, who was a great guy, he's no longer with us, like a lot of the people of this generation. But I talked to him about that game, and he said, Baylor made him feel like a fraud. And Wexler got 10 times the press that Baylor ever did. Baylor played a game that I knew very little about. He said, he showed me things. He reverse dunked on me. Nobody reverse dunked in 1954. You know, and so it was stuff like that. It was just like the intersection, again, of race and sports. There's no one
in history, right,
whose life epitomizes that.
Yeah.
Like him.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about, so he's raised there in a literally legally segregated town. He gets out of the blue, and this is also you know, he was good enough at the time, and I think what you're saying, he was good enough at the time to have made the jump from high school to the pros. It's pretty clear that he was that quality of a player, because he would destroy college players, a good college players, correct, not you know, benchwarmer college players. Talk about how did he end up? I mean, we know ultimately end up in Seattle, but there was a stop between here and there. And for a guy who was raised in a segregated town, it's not exactly the stop you would expect right after high school.
Yeah, well, it goes back, like, we go over, like, as he was getting no acclaim here in the D.C. area that they deserved, except in the black community where everyone understood him. I mean, one of my favorite little D.C. trivia tidbits is the R&B singer Ginuwine, who was big 15, 20 years ago, if you heard him. I mean, his name is Elgin Baylor Lumpkin. I mean, that's one sign of Baylor's acclaim. People name their kids after it.
Right.
But even though he exposed his white counterparts as inferior in these exhibition games, it wasn't strong enough to overcome the racism of George Washington University, Maryland, Georgetown, the three biggest sports universities in the D.C. area at the time, who none of them would have a black player for another decade. So they didn't even, you know, consider. Nobody considered him. And which it just seems, I mean, it seems bizarre now. The guy was selling out, like he was selling out, five, like the Gene Shue match got 5,000 people to come to play.
Right.
But he couldn't, you know, he's got nothing. And here, the only school that showed real interest in him was Virginia Union, which was a historically black college in Richmond. And Baylor had made a deal with his buddy, Warren Williams, which was the reason I just wrote the story. Warren just died of COVID, actually, and lived a great life. His childhood friend of Elgin's. They made a deal. They're going to go to school, and it's going to be far away from D.C. They're not going to live this segregated life anymore. You know, they wanted to, like, there's a big world out there. It's bigger than Washington, D.C., and they wanted, they were going to set out. And Warren he was at his house one day. He actually lived a few blocks from where I live right now. And the neighbors say that a guy in the Harlem Globetrotters, who is a member of their family, had just traveled to Idaho and heard about a school that was taking people. So Warren made a call, goes out there, actually took a train out there by himself, and talks to the football coach, the guy named Sam Vokes, who was such a small school. It turns out he's also the basketball coach. And so he gets a scholarship for himself to College of Idaho, the school of 500 people in a place called Caldwell, Idaho, that Warren had never heard of. Warren had never been out of Washington, D.C. before. But he made a deal with Baylor. They were going to go to school together. He said, the line of Gilly says, first he gets himself a spot on the basketball team also, because Sam Vokes was also the coach of the basketball and football teams. And he says, a friend of mine back home is the greatest basketball player alive, and which is a pretty good recruiting pitch. And Vokes, he talked him into saying, okay, send him out here, but he's got to play football. And so Baylor at first had to agree to play football, and then when he went out there, Vokes had done enough scouting to realize, you know, I'm not going to waste this guy's ability. You know, he'd seen him reverse dunk it by that point.
Exactly.
This ain't a football player. We're not going to, you know, this is a special guy. And Vokes is a very important, I wish he were still alive. He died 15, 16 years ago, because, you know, he talked in, like, maybe the whitest state in the country. Idaho's got to be up there. And he got the administration to agree to let him integrate the program in a massive way. I mean, the basketball team had six black players that year, which, you know, I mean, it's the right thing, but it also probably pretty, you know, revolutionary, pretty radical at the time.
Radical.
1954 in Idaho.
Especially, exactly, yeah. In Idaho. I think I think in your story you said that, what, there were 1,500?
Less than that, 1,050.
1,050?
1,957.
In the entire state.
In the whole state.
Right. Pretty unusual to have six people on one team, right?
Yeah. And anyway, so he calls Baylor up, and then, you know, Baylor, I talked to Baylor about this over the years, and his version of it was that Warren says, come on out to Idaho. And Elgin's response was, okay, where's Idaho? And, but he had nowhere else to go. Like, right. Which is so bizarre.
And what happened to the team when he got there?
Well, I mean, it goes back a little bit. Like, it not only it was, I mean, the team went on the best. They had the best season they'd ever had. They won. They won 18-0, I think it was, or they won 18 games in a row, and they went undefeated in the conference for the first time in the school's history. And the school is old. The school dates back to like the 1800s.
Right.
So it was a historic season, and the people where nobody really cared about basketball too much before, everyone I talked to, there were lines were around the corner, the gym was packed like never before.
Wow. We're talking with Dave McKenna, a writer for The Defector, his dynamite piece on Elgin Baylor. If you know anything about Seattle history, particularly Seattle sports history, you should know Elgin Baylor ended up being a Hall of Famer, played for the Lakers, I think his entire career, if not most of his career, widely considered maybe the greatest basketball player ever to come out of this area. This is Dave's story is about a kid who grew up in Washington, D.C., and ends up playing for College of Idaho, which I hadn't even heard of prior to this piece, and then ends up at Seattle University. So we were just talking. He arrives. He brings a couple of friends, I think, does he not?
Warren brings him, kind of, and then they bring Gary Mays, who is an unbelievable story in his own. There should be books about him. He's a guy who I got to know really, really well, who was a one-armed athlete and also not only a great basketball player who was famous for shutting Elgin down in the senior year. They were undefeated. The Spingarn team was undefeated, and wow. They headed to the city playoffs, the last segregated tournament in D.C. High school sports history. And Gary shut down Elgin, and his Armstrong team beat Spingarn, which made Gary, the one-armed Gary, a celebrity in the black community. But also he was a catcher, which, think about that, he's a one-armed catcher. And I have clippings that have him throwing out, like, well, then one New York, the D.C. Daily News paper about him, said he's thrown out every base dealer this year. A one-armed guy, like, think about the process of catching a pitch and throwing out a guy running down to second. But and he did that at Idaho. He played baseball there. But anyway, so they called Gary up, and, by then, the coach Vokes, he's seeing these guys that, Bell are doing things he'd never seen before. He's going, well, this is, if he says these guys can play back home, they must be able to play. So he had carte blanche to, have two guys, there were three guys from D.C. there, which amazingly he showed the Seattle coach. This is the Baylor's, the awesomeness of Baylor. Like, he got the same deal from the Seattle coach, where he just came back here. He said, I want to bring my friends because we're skipping a chapter here. At the end of the Idaho season, the best season in school's history, Sports Illustrated caught wind of this dynamo going on. And they wrote up the program, and it was like ostensibly a nice piece saying, this school is having the best school season it's ever had. But then it says, but how'd they do it? It says they got lax with the academic standards. And the three examples are three black guys on the team. It's the only examples they give. And they say these guys wouldn't have gotten in this school or any school in the conference if they were, if they stuck to their regular grade restrictions. And Baylor, years later, the Seattle paper just got, enraged. So that, what a bunch of crap that was.
Right. It was an excuse.
He says, never had anything less than a C.
The time in Idaho, what it did do was showcase him to Seattle University's coach, who saw him play and realized, I would imagine that as soon as Idaho canceled its program, he was there to scoop up Elgin Baylor and bring him to Seattle.
Well, it was kind of like, I don't think it was that. I believe Baylor went over to Seattle somehow through some connection and played AAU basketball there for the summer because he couldn't play immediately because of transfer rules.
Oh, right.
And so he played AAU basketball, and that was how, that's where, once you saw Elgin Baylor, you didn't forget him, apparently. I mean, there's so many people in D.C. of his generation who, they just shake their head and laugh, when you talking about seeing Elgin Baylor on the playgrounds. And so, and I guess that's what John Castellani, the coach at Seattle, was his name. He, I guess that's what he saw. And So he made the same deal with Baylor. Baylor said, I want my friends to come. He said, okay, go get them. And it was one of the most touching parts of my, and again, I'm obsessed with Elgin Baylor's story. I believe he's worthy of the obsession. I think there's so much there for anyone who likes sports and culture and the country's history. But one of my favorite parts is, and it gets me kind of weepy. How he used that clout to come back home and give two guys who weren't going to go to college, got them scholarships and degrees, you know, eventually at Seattle. And right. Lloyd Murphy and Saunders were their names. And they were both on the team that, you know, made it to the 1958. You know, he was worth it to the school. He took them all the way pretty much on his back to the championship game of the 1958 NCAA tournament in the Final Four. He was named MVP even though they lost in the final to Kentucky, Adolph Rupp's all-white Kentucky team. And the game was in Louisville, and Baylor got four quick fouls, so, you know, go figure.
Right,
but,
exactly.
And then at the time they had an 11-point lead, and Seattle had an 11-point lead, and then frittered that away with Baylor unable to play at full speed because of the fouls. But
and he was also injured as well, correct?
Say that again?
And he was injured as well, correct?
Yeah, they say he had a rib injury, but, like, you know, I've had a broken rib. I don't think he can. I'm not buying that part of it.
Right.
I don't know. That he played with a broken rib. You know, he is a superhuman, I guess, you know.
Maybe so.
I shouldn't put myself in that. I would not have been able to play in the championship game with a broken rib.
So before we,
Baylor apparently did.
Before we wrap up, and we'll have to wrap up a little bit quickly here, tell us one of the things in the piece that made me laugh out loud was, what was the sign that a coach in Oregon posted regarding when Elgin Baylor was playing for Seattle U, and he was dominating. He wasn't just playing. He was dominating at Seattle U, every single team that they ran into. What was the sign that was on the wall? I think it was a coach in Oregon, right, who posted this sign for his own players.
It was, you know, I don't have it verbatim, but it was something just like, if you want to watch Elgin play, buy a ticket. You know, if you want to sit and watch Elgin, go buy a ticket. Meaning, like, you know, you're going to be, like, because he'd heard people are just so in awe of this guy, they just
stopped guarding him.
As he dunks on him.
Right.
But he makes me, you know, I've seen a lot of sporting events. I mean, but, like, there's some, I'm just like, I find I probably romanticize his era, you know, more than I should for a lot of provincial reasons. It's D.C., you know, he's from D.C., and I know so many of the characters that grew up on the playgrounds at the same time he did. But I just find his story incredibly compelling. I find, you know, and I'm not alone there with it, but I just think he's a special guy, and I think finally he kind of knows it. I don't know if you've ever dealt with him, but he's an incredibly humble guy, and he's just so nice. He doesn't, like, you want him to just, you grab him and say, you know, you were great, right? People really think you were great. It's not clear that he knows that, but I hope he does. I really hope he does.
That was Dave McKenna, writer for The Defector, his dynamite piece on Elgin Baylor. If you don't know anything about Elgin Baylor, you should read this. And if you do know something about Elgin Baylor, you'll learn a lot more taking a look at this on The Defector site. Dave McKenna, thank you so much for joining us. And I got to say, personally, this was the favorite thing that I read this week here in Seattle. Dave, I really appreciate your time.
All right, I'm sorry for rambling. I can't really talk rationally about Elgin Baylor.
That's quite All right. Thank you, Dave.
Right. Thank you so much.
You would come with me on the wings of love and above the clouds, the only way to fly.
Baby, come back. Any kind of food could see.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. A week or two ago, we had on the executive editor of the Seattle Times, Michelle Matassa Flores, to talk about the fact that the Seattle Police Department was trying to get video and photographs from it and other news organizations here in Seattle to help it solve problems, or rather suspected crimes, during the riots in May in Seattle. At the time, let me try that again. At the time, the Seattle Police Department felt like this information would help it complete its investigation, or at least move its investigation forward. Joining us right now is Michelle Matassa Flores. It turns out that maybe the Seattle Police Department did need that information. What just happened with this case?
Well, the police department dropped its subpoena for our unpublished material. And they cited a couple things in doing that. One was the fact that federal investigators had arrested a man suspected of being in possession of one of the stolen weapons. And the other thing they cited was just that our court procedures, when we were appealing this decision, would take too long, that they were needing to move along more urgently.
And at the time, if you could sort of refresh the listener's memory, what was the argument against, or what is the argument against, a news organization turning over unpublished information that it has gathered while reporting on an event in town?
Our most important reason for challenging this was to protect the independence of the media, not just the Seattle Times, but in this case, four local television stations. Journalists need to remain independent of those they cover on all sides. And that is why, there are protections for journalists embedded in our Constitution and in statutes all across the country at the state and federal level.
And what's the burden of proof? When the Seattle Police Department subpoenaed you folks and other news organizations here in Seattle, what is the burden of proof that they have to show in order for them to be able to get this information out of a news organization?
The state shield law is what it's called, lays out basically a four-pronged test that they had to meet, which is to show that our material would be highly relevant and highly material to their case, that it's critical and necessary to their investigation, that they have exhausted all other measures of investigating the case, and that there's a compelling public interest in the case. The judge in this case ruled that they had met those tests. We strongly believe, still do, that they hadn't, especially in the case of exhausting all other measures. They hadn't even gone to the public with a plea using the photos and video that had been publicly published already.
And so the feeling is that they should, at the very least, they should have taken the appropriate steps to do everything they could to solve the crime on their own without turning journalists into subcontractors for law enforcement. What is the danger to journalists if this does happen? If one of your reporters goes out and is on scene and there is this public awareness like, hey, the police can use this as evidence against some person or something. I mean, what does that do to the perception of the journalists when they show up at a protest event like this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple answers to that, Mike. Well, on scene, our people are in physical danger covering these protests. Often the protesters don't want us there. Many, many of them do. There are peaceful protests all the time. The masses who turn out for those protests are happy to get their message out and happy to be covered. There's a small group of protesters who don't want us there. They don't especially want to be captured on camera. And as a result, they get pretty worked up sometimes when we're just trying to do our jobs. We've had our photographers punched, rocks thrown at their head. They've been chased down the block. Their personal information has been put up on the internet, and they've been harassed. Protesters have encouraged others to harass our folks. So their physical safety is on the line. And beyond that, there is a more kind of foundational risk to the principle of independent journalism. We need people to feel like they can talk to us without fear that that will lead to them being arrested, them getting in trouble, them getting fired from a job. There are all kinds of examples of whistleblowers and anonymous sources and all kinds of tipsters and even just regular everyday sources who help us do our jobs, which is to enlighten the public about what's going on and to hold government accountable. And this is why those protections are built into the Constitution.
We're talking with Michelle Matassaflores. She's executive editor of the Seattle Times. Seattle Times, well, at least the Seattle Police Department just rescinded its request or its demand for unpublished information from the Seattle Times and other news organizations. They just rescinded this demand yesterday. It was expected to end up probably in a little bit of a court fight for a period of time to decide whether or not the police even had access to this. One more question, Michelle, before I let you go. What is talk a little bit about that tension between being a journalist and being a citizen, because I think I know that you folks received a lot of blowback from people when you said, no, we're not going to turn over this information. That is not our job out there to be an adjunct for the police department. But talk about that tension between, you know, you're a journalism organization, the most important one in the city, and yet it's a city also that most of your journalists are citizens of the city, and they have responsibilities there too. How do you square those tensions?
Well, and first of all, I should say we did get some blowback. We also got a whole lot of support from people who understood where we're coming from and understood and still understand the importance of a free and independent press. Yes, we're trained to put aside personal feelings and to believe that what we do is a higher calling than our own personal feelings or personal involvement in any political issues might result in, I guess. And that's not a very articulate way to put it. But journalism, by, as I said, illuminating facts and holding government accountable, we have a unique position to help make society better, and that's the role and mission that we're fulfilling every day. And it can be hard. We get all kinds of blowback, to use your word, on from all sides on many, many stories. And this year, I would say more than ever in my career, which is 35 years, I think. It's very heightened right now. It's really difficult. Our people are exhausted and stressed out, but it's also still very rewarding work. I say still more so again than ever, probably rewarding work that we believe in and that keeps us going.
That was Michelle Matassaflores, executive editor of the Seattle Times. Michelle, thanks again for joining us on Cairo Nights, and glad you folks don't have to spend a whole bunch of money in court fighting the Seattle Police Department over these images. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. We are too.
And coming up in the next hour, of course, we'll be talking to Stacey Jo Rust, but the conversation takes a pretty weird turn when we find out that Jake Heaps, the cleanest cut person in all of Cairo, maybe in all of the Puget Sound area, had an unexpected interaction with police. Coming up after the break at the top of the hour. Welcome back to the show. Once again, we are facing down the Questrotron 700. It is there to make us look bad. We are here to let it know that the machines are not yet dominant.
Will not take over.
We are not letting them take over, not yet, not at least until the end of this episode. Frank, we're starting with you.
Lucky me.
What are some obscure things that you are really into?
Oh, Lord. It has to be obscure?
Okay. Something that somebody else maybe isn't into.
I've talked about this before. I have an enormous collection of American Flyer trains. Now, these are trains that Lionel makes them today, but really, strictly speaking, these are trains that were built in the 40s, the 50s, and into the 60s. So, I mean, most of the stuff I have, rolling stock that I have, is probably 50 years old. And I love all of it. I love dragging it out and putting it up on the floor and the whole thing.
All right. Shane?
I just really love the study of music and culture, and I find that I really get obsessed over kind of just certain weird types of movements in music. One thing that I find obscure that I'm into is Soviet Union punk rock during the time of the fall of communism was happening in the 80s.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah,
I did a podcast in college with somebody who did a museum exhibit on the subject, and some of the weird stuff that comes out of that I think is pretty neat.
That is neat.
All right, so for me, what's an obscure thing I'm really into? I think that, I don't know, it doesn't feel that it's big in a lot of other countries, not as big in the United States, but there's a lot of different motorcycle racing that I follow. Follow a motorcycle race at the Isle of Man very closely. I've actually been there, traveled to it. If you know about it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, it's a fairly dangerous motorcycle race. Obviously, I'm a spectator. I'm not a participant in anything like this. I'm both too old and way too scared to do anything like that. But I find motorcycle racing in particular, and bicycle racing, fantastic. I would rather watch motorcycle racing than football any day of the week. That's how much I like it. But I also understand that I just kind of keep it to myself because I'm in a minority in this newsroom and in this country. So I understand that it's not for everyone, but for me, it's pretty special.
That's pretty cool.
All right.
Love the blinking lights.
What is this is a kind of a broad one here. We're going to go with Shane. What is the best way a person can spend their time?
Doing something that they either love or that's going to put them in a position to do something that they're going to love. That's what I'd say. I've always grown up in a really, kind of a very blue-collar workaholic kind of environment in my family, and I think the best thing that you could do is being able to make use of your time and, try to just better yourself or put yourself in a position to be where you want to be one day.
Frank? No, go ahead, Frank.
I would have said that, but since you've said it, I'll take a second thing, which is I think being with somebody that you love and spending lots of time listening to them and chatting with them. I think that's fantastic.
I agree with both of those. But I don't know. I think that the best way a person can spend their time is to get comfortable with themselves and their own head. I think that people need to be a lot kinder to themselves, I think, and that's the only way you're going to really learn to have relationships with other people. That's the only way you're ever going to trust them anyway. And so I think I'm not saying that people should be selfish, but I am saying that they should spend good time being inward looking and seeing where they're at on the planet. All right.
That's good. Agreed. Sure. We got time?
Yeah. One more. All right. Oops.
It's your turn.
Question. It's, I know. It's coming up. Oh, this is an easy one for me. An easy one for me. I'm glad I got this one.
Crap.
Do you like documentaries? Why and why not? I love documentaries. I don't know that there's a form of film that I like more than documentaries. I mean, I like, fiction films, and I like, I do love film. I don't know that I'm a film buff just from a lack of time, but if I had more time, I'd be more of a film buff. But documentaries, when I do have the time, I dive in. In fact, I just watched the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary. I just watched the Social Dilemma Dynamite documentary on the problems of algorithms within social media. It's on Netflix right now. I highly recommend it. I can go on and on and on. Frank?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I am a film buff. And remember, I talked last night about seeing Iron Man and finishing it up?
Yep.
Well, after I finished it up, I watched all the documentaries that are attached to it, which is like an hour and a half of documentary stuff.
And
they're great. Yeah. I mean, I love all of the little intricacies of making those movies, and Iron Man in particular was so trendsetting.
Can I just jump in real quick on that? So one of the things I hate watching is anything involving how a movie was made.
Why?
I don't know. The only one that I liked was watching them build the cars for Fury Road. I really, really liked that.
I remember that.
But I don't want that in a movie.
Well,
I hate it when they pull away in those director ends when you can see like all the camera apparatus around the battle scene. I'm like,
crap.
Crap. Anyway, Jane?
Documentaries are my favorite thing to watch of all time. I love the act of being lazy and still learning and doing something. So documentaries really help out with that. And my aunt, I have a British side of my family that live in the south of London, and my aunt used to make documentaries for BBC.
Wow.
For
some of the best.
That's cool.
Years. So, yeah, I've always loved documentaries.
All right, then. Thanks, folks, for listening. We are going to be back in the next hour with Stacey Joe Rost. We're going to talk a little bit. Well, we always talk a little bit about the Seahawks. We always talk actually quite a lot about the Seahawks, but you'll be surprised about this conversation right after the break.